Time to turn our attention to climate and weather now with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and Professor John Martin, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. Steve's with us right now. John's on his way, I would guess.
Yeah, he teaches now. He's starting in the spring semester, yep. So he comes late and
he
walks.
He comes a little late.
Yeah, and there's wonderful weather we're having.
Wonderful weather. Boy, I tell you what, give us a call with your weather or climate questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And whatever happened to that January thaw?
Whatever happened to that January thaw? Actually, it's coming. It's coming. Yeah, usually if you do the average temperatures, we have our minimum around early 20s in January. And then it warms up a little bit, and then it gets cold again.
Yeah.
And actually,
usually about the third week of January.
Usually, right. That's right. And we kind of skip that, although in about 4 or 5 days from now, it's going to get above what the normal temperatures are going to be. So it's going to get up near freezing. So we're kind of hitting that January thaw, but a little bit later than we normally have it or want it. I was very excited for it this weekend, and it never came.
Well, I'm still hearing people say, well, how can you talk about global warming when we've got this kind of weather?
Yeah, but remember, global warming is an average, and it's global. There are, along these averages, there's always going to be ups and downs. And so we have to look at the long-term trend. And it's interesting in terms of the state of Wisconsin is in general for January, its average temperature for a variety of cities throughout Wisconsin are below normal. But this is not uncommon. But if you look at the 10-year average, then we're above normal. So you got to kind of integrate over time.
All right. You got to integrate over time. Well, what's the weather going to be like next month?
Let's wait to February 2nd. And we'll see what the little furry animals say.
Oh, man. There was a photo of cumulonimbus cloud above a supercell thunderstorm near Lusk, Wyoming, received the most votes in the cool clouds category of USDA Today's photo contest. What are the characteristics of a cumulonimbus cloud?
Yeah, the cumulonimbus cloud is basically a thunderstorm. And so any storm that has lightning means it has thunder, and therefore it's classified as a thunderstorm or a cumulonimbus. That particular picture that I saw, which is actually pretty amazing, is unique in that it's what we call a supercell storm. So if you live in Florida, you know, we have these little cumulonimbus storms develop and die, and they last about a half an hour or an hour at the most. These supercell storms are basically one big storm, and they're super in size, and they last a super long time for an individual cell. And they do that because they're the updraft, the up-moving air that maintains the storm, is tilted and spiraled. And those two things together kind of help it maintain a long lifetime as opposed to a short one.
Mm-hmm. Well, I haven't seen that picture.
It's quite fascinating. You could see the updraft part of it, and then the anvil part of it is, it looks like it's stretching out towards the photographer. So it's pretty ominous looking.
No doubt. Don in Fenimore, your turn now. Hi, Don. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call. Thank you, Steve. I would like to know why during the summer months a lot of times you'll see these weather storms, or I should say summer storms, thunder and lightning and rainstorms moving in from the west to the east across, and they hit the Wisconsin River. And you can just watch, or the Mississippi River, excuse me, and you can just see them break up as they hit the river.
Boy, yeah. You know, not only do you see them break up when they hit the river, but you also see them break up when they come to Madison. And I don't necessarily think that that is a geographical feature as opposed to this is something that we want to happen. You know, we want to get this thunderstorm here. But a lot of times with regard to thunderstorms seeming like they break up around the Mississippi, a lot of those thunderstorms are developing on the edge of a high-pressure system that's kind of centered over the Midwest. And it's on the outskirts of that high-pressure system where these storms can develop.
Okay.
But during the center of the storm, like where it might be over Wisconsin, there's generally air that's sinking. And that's not very good for getting thunderstorms to develop. So I think that's why you see that right around the border of Minneapolis and Minnesota and western Wisconsin.
All right. Yeah. Thanks for calling, Don. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at talk@wpr.org. And Jim Packard had provided me with a picture, and I just didn't notice it beforehand, of that cumulonimbus cloud.
That is a very striking. Yeah, it's pretty scary, isn't it?
Oh, man. It is.
And it's out there by itself, and there's nothing else around it, and blue sky behind it. But you can, I'll bet it's hailing someplace there.
Well, let's talk about tornadoes for a minute. Is there, we talked about global warming, or just mentioned it a few minutes ago. Is there any link between global warming and tornadoes?
You know, that's a really interesting question, because there was actually some work being done on that right now. There was an article that came out in the American Geophysical Union newspaper that somebody looked at that. And what they pointed out was that if you look at the number of reported tornadoes over the last 50 years, there's been a 14% increase in the number of tornadoes.
Oh.
Now, the interesting part of that, he points out, is that whether or not that's a robust statistic that we can actually believe that we're getting this increase is still up in the air.
Sure.
Because, you know, the number of tornadoes that we get is actually requires sightings. So 50 years ago, not as many people were as trained to detect these things. Plus, there weren't as many people around to be looking at them. And so there's research now going on trying to figure out whether or not this is actually a real trend, or is it just coincidence? Because the other bad part about tornadoes is that they're very small. And so being small, localized, short time periods, it's really hard to get accurate statistics in a 50-year period.
Bob in Blue Mounds, we'll turn to you next. Hi, Bob.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, I still hear people who seem to know a little science deny global warming based on some specifics that, in particular, they cite these old integral functions that they try to that are involved in all the models that take into account the depth of the atmosphere and how much re-radiation will heat up the atmosphere, and they're saying that these old integral solutions are still in use in the models. So my question is, aren't there many models, and haven't they overcome some of those older limitations? And finally, is there a good website that deals with these kind of the denial of global warming in particular? I haven't been able to find a good site. I've looked on the IPCC site, but they don't deal so much directly with how to counter some of the lack of facts that are being still portrayed out there.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. And I came across a website the other day, about 2 weeks ago. I was looking for something else and then came across this website. But I can't remember who it was that put it up. I would begin, if I were to look at this again, looking for the Union of Concerned Scientists.
Okay.
That's probably a good start to look at it. But you're right. I mean, the climate modeling and weather modeling, both of those activities have really improved in the last 10 to 15 years. They've improved with our improved understanding of how the atmosphere works and how it's coupled to the ocean and coupled to the land surfaces, plus our ability in terms of computation and computer capability. All of these have kind of worked together, that the models that we're running now are very much different than the very simple models we were running even 15, 20 years ago. Now, that's not to say they're perfect. There are still definite weaknesses in them. And we're learning as time goes on how to handle those weaknesses better and better. But, you know, the good models are able to predict consistent results between what we're currently observing in the last 20, 25 years, as well as things that happened in the past. And it's those two things together that give us confidence that when we project into the future, the trends, particularly with global, are very reasonable.
Hmm. All right.
One of the things he says is that temperatures have been going down globally in the last 10 years. Is there any truth to that?
No.
I didn't think so.
Not surface air temperatures by any means, no.
Right. All right. Thanks a lot. Yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. Excuse me. Appreciate your call. you know, you mentioned the problem, you know, figuring out whether or not tornadoes have increased because 50 years ago there weren't as many people around. I was thinking about something like sea surface temperatures.
Oh, right, yeah.
Now, that's something that, you know, you would have a handle on from 40 or 50 years ago. Are they higher worldwide than they were 40 years ago, let's say?
Yeah, the sea surface temperatures in general have also increased over the last 20, 25 years or so. It's interesting in that same problem with the tornadoes is that until the advent of satellites, sea surface temperatures were also very spotty in the sense that, you know, we get them from ships.
Yeah.
And so you're only going to get them where the ship routes go.
Oh, sure.
But they do extend back much further in time because, the, you know, the shipping people are generally interested in fish and they know that good fishing is correlated with water temperatures. And so these measurements have been made over a long period of time.
So what effect does that have, or does it have an effect on weather?
It has a pretty big effect on weather, or at least climate in the sense, because as the ocean temperatures begin to warm, what that generally means is that we're going to, among other things, have increased evaporation. And so that is going to potentially put more water into the atmosphere that's going to allow for recycling. Through storms, for example. And so there's, along with the temperature warming of the atmosphere, those two things coupled together, many models are forecasting and predicting that precipitation is generally going to go up globally. Now, that's not clear for every single region of the world. Some areas may actually get drier while other regions get wetter. But in general, we're looking at a more wetter world.
You wonder if places like the Sahara...
Right, yeah, yeah. What's going to happen to that? I think the Sahara is still, I don't see anybody predicting that the Sahara is going to wetten up, get precipitation. Even though in the past, the Sahara, the regions of the Sahara was very wet. I mean, there are caves in the Sahara and Saudi Arabia where there's drawings of hippopotami and crocodiles, you know, and those are things that live in very, very moist environments. So at one point, those areas were very wet, but... once they dry out, it's hard to change that that cycle around again.
Our guest today is Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, and John Martin joining us, chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Climate and weather on our minds now with our two guests, Professor Steve Ackerman and Professor John Martin, our weather guys from the UW-Madison. John just joining us now. And John, you know, you predicted that we would not have 100 inches of snow in the Madison area.
And boy, is my money looking good.
We must be getting close to halfway there.
Oh, we're over half. We're at 54.6 or something like that. But a conspicuous lack of snow since about the first week of January. And it looks like it'll continue right through the first week of February. In fact, it'll warm up by about February, first few days of February, maybe.
So there'd have to be a really miserable end of February.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you can count on 12 inches in March, probably all in one day before the tournament. And then something maybe in the middle of February. But, boy, we need about four of them. I don't see it.
You're looking better. Let's go to Nell in Brookfield. Hi, Nell. Thanks for calling.
I haven't heard anybody talking about this before, and so I'm just wondering, even though it's all fairly low in the atmosphere, the constant building and building and building and building and all these corridors where the wind just whips, like where I live, it was not so such strong winds until Blue Mound got completely built up and you know, the nonstop building up subdivisions and what all, and that must have some effect, that and the paving over of everything where the water, the groundwater can't get refilled, and there must be a whole lot more evaporation going on. Certainly that must have an effect on climate, because it's certainly countrywide and pretty much worldwide. You know, just these tall buildings that are just, you know, just lines and lines and lines of them. Where the wind whips through, it must make more evaporation and makes it drier, and it has to change the patterns a bit, I would think.
Well,
Yeah, I think it's certainly true that if one were to talk about a microclimatology, like a climatology around a city or in the Chicagoland area, for instance, or the Milwaukee area, no doubt that such things are climate changing for those locations. You know, there's a lot more runoff of precipitation instead of soaking into the ground, as you said, when you pave it over. And there's no doubt that when someone gives a wind chill advisory for the suburbs of Chicago, the last place you want to be is on Michigan Ave, where the wind's going to be at least twice as large because of all the funneling between buildings. Yeah, it's just going to be much worse wind-wise. I don't know off the top of my head if people have actually measured the increases in wind speed or evapotranspiration or anything like that in urban areas. Someone must have done it, and I just don't know it off the top of my head.
Yeah, yeah. I guess I'm thinking of scale-wise, because, I mean, the things you're pointing out are definitely true. I mean, we do get the urban heat island effect. Mm. And so cities, as they grow and do more paving and make more buildings, generally leads to a warming of the environment. What I was thinking as you were talking about this is that it's kind of interesting because as you build buildings, yeah, you generate these wind tunnel effects, which make the wind speed up. But on the larger scale, what you're doing is really increasing the terrain and therefore increasing friction. Hmm. And so on the large scale, you know, I mean, winds are going to be generally stronger over a flat area than over a forest or things like that. And so I'm not sure what the net effect is, because locally, as John's saying, you're increasing the wind speed. But on a larger scale, the increased friction as wind runs into buildings and things, you may actually lowering it.
Yeah, I hadn't thought of that. That's a really good point. And I was going to also suggest, I think along the lines of what Steve's saying, that probably on the very large scale, the continental scale, cities don't make much difference. But certainly on the citywide scale, they do. And I hadn't thought of that. You're right. Yeah. It probably would reduce the wind speeds overall.
Thanks, Nell. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Rich in New Berlin, up next. Hi, Rich. Thank you for calling.
Well, good afternoon. There's a great global warming debate. I just saw a chart last week that looks like it's the global warming is nothing more than a naturally occurring cycle that's been occurring for the last million years or so, possibly influenced maybe no more than 2 degrees. By our carbon destruction. Any takes on that?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I would say the debate on global warming is largely over. The lights in the audium have dimmed, the curtains have closed, and people are leaving the stadium because, you know, generally the science evidence, both from, you know, instrumentations by humans as well as observations of the natural environment, all indicate that it's occurring. The debate, I think, is now beginning to shift towards mitigation and what's the other word I'm looking
regional
for?
Regional effects, I think.
Yeah, and regional effects.
Yeah. Those are the next two places.
Yeah. And so by regional effects, some regions may get colder or
the degree to which the climate change is going to affect our particular region. You know, like will we warm up, and if so, to what degree? Will we only get warm in the summer and not in the winter? Will we get more snowfall in the winter or less snowfall?
Okay, I see.
It's those
saying.
Types of regional questions. You know?
Interesting.
Particularly around the Great Lakes. I mean, what's going to happen to the Great Lakes? That's kind of a really interesting
it's a big issue, right?
Scenario.
Thanks, Rich, for calling. John in Luck, we'll turn to you now. Hi, John.
Good day. I'm calling about the solar cycle. I've been watching on a website the sunspot activity, which is often correlated, you know, with the solar cycles, the 11-year period. And the new solar cycle is some months late. And according to historical reports, the only other time this has happened was just prior to the Little Ice Age, the Mander Minimum. Do our guests have any opinion on whether we might be entering another Little Ice Age similar to that in which the solar output is reduced and thus the warming is offset by the cooling?
I have heard a whiff of a connection people are beginning to think about between the solar cycle and the current minimum in sunspot activity and changes in some of the larger, longer-term scale oscillations that have been identified in the atmosphere in the last 30, 40, 50 years. The one that comes to mind is the Pacific Decadal Oscillation may respond, some people have thought, and I don't know if it's been proven or really analyzed in any detail, it may respond to the sunspot cycle. And consequently, when they go into a minimum, it may enter its cool phase. So that's definitely something people are looking into.
Yeah. But I wouldn't bet on a colder environment in the next 10 years or so.
Yeah, because we can go through, go back to 22 years from now or so, you can find episodes where you might have expected it to be cold and it wasn't.
But it wasn't, right, yeah. So even though we've had a cold winter, that's just a...
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call very much. You can join in, too, at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@WPR.org as we talk climate and weather with our weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. Hurricane Ike was the biggest storm of 2008's hurricane season. What are you thinking about future hurricane? Do you expect future hurricane rainfall and wind speeds are going to increase in response to human human-caused warming?
I mean, we're generally talking about there's a couple of things that drive hurricanes. One of which is sea surface temperature, and so there's a lot of research going out there. And I'm not sure I remember the latest, but with regard to increasing sea surface temperatures, you would expect that you would get more intense hurricanes. But you also have to worry about the wind fields that these things are embedded in, whether or not there's a lot of variation in wind speed and direction with height. If there's too much of that, then hurricanes don't form.
Yeah, and some people now are also talking about ocean heat content as maybe even a better measure of than the sea surface temperature, which has long been, as Steve says, the main thing that people are pin their hat onto when they expect a hurricane to develop. But it may matter how deep the warm water is. If it's very shallow, then once one storm goes by, it's churned up the water enough so that it's now cold in that spot. And if it's very deep, it takes a lot of storms before it gets cold there, and that might increase the number and in intensity of hurricanes.
And I think I would forecast this, that although this doesn't have to do much with weather and climate, is that I would forecast that the population along the coastlines is going to increase in the next, continue to increase, I should say, in the next 50 years. And so whether or not hurricane amounts are going to increase with global warming or stay the same, it's going to become much more of a threat just because there are more people living there. And if there is, and there continues to be an increase in sea level, then also that's going to cause a problem with hurricanes.
Yeah, and it also means the number of people who have not experienced a hurricane increases. And consequently, the heedance they take to warnings goes down on the aggregate, and that's not good.
Yeah.
So there are some things like that figure in.
Jeff in Janesville, we're on to you now. Hi, Jeff.
Afternoon, fellas. Hey, I was thinking of you guys a couple weeks ago. It was one of those mornings. It was 24 below zero. I was driving into work, and the sun had not yet come over the horizon. However, to the left and to the right of it, I think they're called sun dogs. You saw the vertical coloration. It was rather beautiful. And as I was driving at it, I was trying to figure out how far away do those phenomena occur from the sun. And, of course, okay, that's all. It's like what diameters of the sun or how far away. But as I was driving closer to it, it almost looked like it was very close to my truck. I could see the colors in the cornfields on the side with the snow, and it looked like it was very close to me. What determines kind of where those sun dogs occur?
So let me go back a minute. You said that the sun was still below the horizon?
Correct. And although it did remain, even once the sun crested, you could still see them.
And how high up were they? How high above the sun were they then?
Oh, they were quite a bit higher. I mean, even before they came, I'd say, maybe two or three diameters of the sun.
Then you didn't see a sun dog. You saw something much more rarer, I think, because I've seen it very few times. Because the sun dogs occur right to the right and left of where the sun is. And that's why they're called sun dogs, because they faithfully follow the master up and down. So if the sun is below the horizon and you're seeing these things up in the air, they're probably something called tangent arcs. Yeah, and I've only seen them twice in my lifetime. And they're usually the color's very bright and intense.
Then
it's probably a tangent arc. And they occur generally when there's kind of the same thing as sun dogs. You need these ice crystals, but generally in a much less concentration than what you see the sun dogs in. And in terms from the distance from the sun, generally we think of it in terms of an angle. So the sun dogs are generally about 22 degrees away from the sun. And so what that is in distance is I'm having a hard time translating that from an angular distance to a real distance.
No, I understand what you're saying, though. Yeah.
But the tangent arcs generally occur further than that. I think they're more like in the 40, 42 degree range away from the sun. So that makes them like further away than where the sun dogs would be.
Very interesting. Yeah. Did it have anything to do with how extremely cold it was that morning, or just likely that there was more ice crystals closer to the Earth because it was so cold?
I think it had to do with that combination exactly, is that when you get cold, very cold air, then you have a likelihood of generating more ice crystals. And sometimes when it gets really cold, you generate this thing near the ground called diamond dust, where you get these very long needle-like structures. And sometimes you'll see the air actually scintillate if you look around a light post or something like that. Mm. So I think it was just a combination of cold air, having enough crystals around to see it, and being in the right place at the right time and smart enough for you to be looking up.
Thanks a lot, guys.
Yeah, thanks, Jeff. Someone else emailed in and wondered if there's such a thing as fog dogs, F-O-G dogs, fog dogs.
I would say no.
But do they mean sun dogs that form in the fog, maybe?
Yeah, but you would need an ice fog, because the sun dogs to form, you need ice crystals. Mm. And generally, fogs are made of liquid. You can get a fog bow, but in that case, the sun is behind your back, whereas with sun dogs, you're looking towards the sun.
Toward the sun. We just did a few days ago have a freezing fog advisory, and there was freezing fog around. I wonder if this was recent enough that it would have fallen into those days.
One of the things I noticed this morning driving in, I was driving in about 7 o'clock or so, there was a sun pillar.
I love those.
Now, what do they look like?
It's just if you look at the sun, the sun was just above the horizon, you get this pillar of light that just extends upward.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
Away from the sun. It's kind of like a searchlight beam that goes upward, and it was pink. It was just gorgeous, and I didn't have a camera with me, and somebody was right behind me, so I couldn't slow down. But they're pretty. I've only seen those maybe 5 or 6 times in my life.
Yeah, I haven't seen them that often. A couple of times, though, it's very striking.
Yeah, it's just really pretty.
Dorothy and Ladysmith, we're on to you now. Hi, Dorothy.
Hi. I have a question about an article that I read in the newest National Wildlife magazine. And it's in the environment section, and it is concerned about a ticking time bomb in the Arctic, and that's a question. And what the concern is that it seems though climate scientists are aware of massive levels of greenhouse gas that are very heat-trapping power of carbon dioxide, and that they would be released into the air from, methane coming from the subsea permafrost, indicating that the sea bottom might be melting and freeing this potential greenhouse gas. Are you aware of this, and would you care to comment on it?
What is it called? Clathrate or something like that, or calthrate? I can't remember.
It might
be frozen peat moss or something.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when the Arctic warms up, there's a tremendous amount of methane is what I thought was the gas. Maybe it's both methane and carbon dioxide, but I'd heard about methane more prominently. There's a lot of methane gas trapped in frozen debris from prior vegetation that would easily make its way into the atmosphere, and that is an important greenhouse gas as well. So I think that's a real concern. People are onto that. The Arctic is such a fragile region and such an important one for the rest of the globe. So many things could go wrong if the Arctic really gets warm. First of all, there'd be a lot less, a lot more heat content from the underlying ocean put into the atmosphere, and that's going to warm up the Arctic by itself. And then you'd have some of this thawing of the permafrost, which is a real disaster waiting to happen. So it could roll down the hill very fast.
Yeah. I mean, greenhouse gas is basically defined as a gas that doesn't absorb at solar energy wavelengths, but does absorb at the radiation energy that the Earth emits. Everything that has a temperature is emitting some sort of radiation. It's just a matter of how energetic it is. And the hotter the object, like the sun, the more energy, the higher energy it emits. And the thing about methane is that it is transparent to solar radiation, so it doesn't absorb solar radiation, but it absorbs radiation at which the Earth's surface emits a lot of energy at. And so that's why people get concerned when they start talking about huge amounts of methane going into the atmosphere, just because of that area, that wavelength regime that they absorb energy at is pretty critical.
Thanks again for calling. Someone else wondered how to find the record low temperatures for a specific area. Is there some place you can go to find the record lows?
For Wisconsin, I'd go to the state climatology office.
Yeah, that'd be a great source. Yeah. And if it was some city I didn't know about, I might just Google that city. Record cold in Toledo, Ohio, and somebody's probably going to have that on their website. Steve's right. If it's for Wisconsin, the state climatology office is a great place.
And you can join in with your question at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions or comments. Tom in Menominee wonders if there have been any changes in the North Atlantic convective flow, and would this be key to changes in our Midwestern climate?
Yeah, he might be referring to the thermohaline circulation in the ocean. The North Atlantic is a place where there's a lot of up and down movement of water in the water column, and that helps to drive the circulation of over the whole Atlantic basin from the subtropics all the way to the pole, of warm water from the tropics and then cool water at the surface and then cool water at very low levels in the ocean back to the low latitudes where it presumably over hundreds of years gets warmed up again and so on. And if that vertical motion in the water column in the North Atlantic stops, that can really screw up the circulation. And one way that it might stop is if we have a lot of melting of ice onto the top of the ocean, because that really fundamentally puts a cap on that vertical part of the circulation, and then that drives the whole thing. So as far as I know, that's not in danger today, but that is one of the key things that people look at for what's called rapid climate change, which is a concern.
Mm-hmm. So it could have an effect on our Midwest climate.
It surely would. Yeah, if you'd be so much different atmospheric circulation to try and make up the difference, that it's hard for me to know what those regional impacts would be, but there would be some for sure. It'd probably be colder here.
Dan in Wausau, your turn now. Hi, Dan.
Hello. I'm just curious if you guys are familiar with Jim Hansen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I read recently that Jim Hansen has stated that he simply, from where he sits, cannot rule out the possibility of a 20-foot rise in sea level by 2100. And the other thing I'd like you to discuss briefly, if you're familiar with it, is global dimming has been theorized to be canceling some of the warming we otherwise would have had. If you're familiar with that theory, if you could discuss that. And I'll take my answers off the air.
Okay, thanks for calling.
Yeah, I think the key phrase that Hansen is saying with regard to global warming is can't rule out, you know, which in many ways is a probabilistic statement in that it can happen. But it would be interesting then to poke him or question him about what do you think is the probable thing that's going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, he could rule out a 100-foot sea level rise by 2100.
That's right.
Yeah.
But so he's saying it's on the far end of possible. So, yeah, it would be a really good question to ask him, wouldn't
it? Yeah,
And then the other part was the
There was a global dimming.
Global dimming, right, right. Yeah.
Yeah, which is, and I forget this way it works. I think the way it works is that the aerosols in the atmosphere are absorbing solar energy. And so that the amount of solar energy that gets reflected back to back to space is less, and therefore the globe looks dimmer if you were living out in some other Jupiter looking in on us. And I think that's the way that it works. And what that would lead to is, of course, an increased warming because the aerosols are absorbing some extra energy. But I think things are counter to that. I think the aerosols are generally causing the brightening.
Yeah, and they reflect more than anything, don't they?
Right, right.
That's what they think. But it is a big question mark.
Yes, right, yeah.
The behavior and importance of aerosols.
Yeah, and there's contradictory evidence to it in terms of what role it's playing.
Peg in Chilton, your turn. Hi, Peg.
Hi. I wanted to give some information about the origin of the term black ice, because I think it's been misused lately.
Oh, good.
I first heard the term about 20 to 25 years ago when we lived in the Twin Cities, and we were having a winter where it had been below zero for almost a week. And at that time, with temperatures, especially in the morning commute time of 20, 30 below, the exhaust fumes would actually freeze as they came out of the car and would leave a slick surface at stop signs. And because the content included the exhaust products, the ice actually was black and hard to see. And so when they warned against black ice on those very cold days, that's what they were talking about.
That's not my definition of black ice.
Yeah, me either.
My definition of black ice is actually clear ice, but it makes the roadway look wet. And if you wet a roadway, it makes it blacker. So black ice is actually transparent ice.
Same in Seattle. That's how they use it in Seattle.
Yeah.
Interesting.
In fact, bicyclists have this thing called gray ice, which is, you know, basically ice on sidewalks that they're biking on.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to close. I'm sorry, we're out of time. Thanks, guys. You'll be back the last Monday of next month. We'll do it again.
And we can check in on John and the snowfall amounts.
Yes.
Yeah, we'll be closer to that golden finish line by then. I'll be ready to talk.
Steve Ackerman, Director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies, John Martin, Chair of the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison, our guest. Thanks for listening. Stay with us.